It's been 30 years.
Yeah.
30 years since Incognito first formed, and that was the first record on a double A side with, what was it, double A side? Parisian Girl?
I think Parisian Girl was the A side. This was the B.
This is my A side.
Yeah, I know.
Summer's ended Incognito.
Mine too.
Bluey, how are you?
Brilliant, mate.
But this is quite dramatic, actually, because this is maybe possibly the last ever interview in Brownswood.
Wow.
Because, as you know, the place is about to be inhabited by different people. Yeah. And I'm looking for a space to put all my records and everything. Yeah. So that's quite radical. And the other thing that's quite radical is that the first interview I ever did...
That's right.
...was in the garden shed of my parents' house in Sutton, Cheam area, Cheam, South London. And I had invited a few different people to come, whose fan clubs I was a part of.
Yeah.
I was a member of the Level 42 fan club. Yeah. I was a member of the Light of the World fan club, and I was a member of the Incognito fan club. And I'm sure I wrote letters to Mark King, and maybe Freeze. I was in a fan club of theirs, but you were the one who responded, and you came.
That's right.
All the way from Tottenham.
From Tottenham, and your mum gave us tea and biscuits.
How old was I? I must have been 16 or something.
Yeah, you were teenager.
Incredible. Yeah. And that was basically on the back of going down to my local record shop and buying a copy of Jazz Funk. So it would have been 1980.
Yeah, it would have been 80, yeah. That's right.
And you've survived it. We've both survived it.
We're not only survived it, bro. We're still a major part of it.
Yeah.
You know, we're at this. You know, I feel like I'm at the center of the musical sphere that I'm into. You know, so.
And you've got
you're
a big,
definitely above me.
A big. So. Well, you've got a big, big, big show coming up. At the O2 Indigo, which is basically celebrating 30 years of Incognito. So you're going for it, because the last time you did a big show was at the Forum, and I remember Chris Hill was there.
Yeah,
and
25th anniversary, wasn't it?
It was the 25th, yeah. Right? And this is the 30th. So yeah. What's going to be different between this one and the last one?
Well, we've done some more albums since then, for a start. And, how much? You know, it's like an Incognito changes, you know? It's like the band, you know, the band's been changing. I've got new musicians, I've got... and the story, you know, it's like the story keeps on changing. And we've got this audience. I mean, I've just come back from Italy, right, where we did a week in Italy playing places like Lecce and Ischia Island. It's very strange places that I've never played to before, amphitheatres and stuff. And it's like 50% are people from back in the Talking Loud days that discovered us then. Italy found us through, you know, the stuff that you released, really, on Talking Loud. But then there's this new audience. Mm. There's these, you know, teenage kids. Mm. So I expect the audience will be like this at the O2, you know, the Indigo on the 22nd.
There's no bands who are as good as you, mate. That's the thing. I mean, the whole point, well, I don't mean that in a kind of, well, I do mean it in a sort of, you know, praise to you way, because you deserve it and because you've been doing it for so many years. In a way, let's go back to the beginnings, because you were kind of part of Freeze, part of Light of the World. You were part of that, the hub of all of those groups.
Yeah.
Bring us back to sort of 1979 and the spirit of London and the movement. I mean, was this a very small scene at the time?
It was small, but in a way, kind of this project, really, Incognito, really describes what was going on, because Tubbs went down to a place, a little wine bar, to go and have a drink with his girlfriend. And it was called Sour Grapes, you know, and he met Jeff Dunn, you know, and Jeff Dunn in turn introduced Tubbs to a guy who he was playing with the next night, which was George Lee, the saxophonist from Africa. And he came down to play on Parisian Girl. You know, I'd gone to a little pub in the East End after finishing a session with, I think I'd been rehearsing with a reggae band in the East End of London. And I'd come out and I'd gone into a pub and I met the guy who played flute on this track. You know, it's like he was sitting there with a flute at the table, Neil Metcalf. So London was one of those places where wherever you went, there was like musicians and there was live music and jam sessions. And you would invite people over. This band, you know, three or four days before we did this, we didn't know there was going to be a flute player on this track. You know, I had this little melody. Tubbs had the bass line, you know, in my bedroom. We were practicing it, you know, and I was singing the melody and playing the chords on my guitars, which was later transferred to the Fender Rhodes. You know, so it's like very organic, very, very London scene. You know, find people within 2 days, you know, that you meet along the way and go, yeah, come down to the studio. We're going to do this project. Invited Peter Hines and G Bello down, you know, to play percussion and keyboards and just... cut it that way, you know.
Because the mad thing was, I did a thing recently on the radio. I did a Brit Funk special on Radio 1, and I just thought it'd be nice to sort of listen back to that sound. And it was great. And I did a night in a club. We just played only that music. And I was going through all these tunes, and a lot of it was sort of between 79, 80, 81, 82. It was like in that really intense period of time, you had a real movement that was crossing over into the charts as well. So you had kind of...
That was a strange thing.
You had High Tension. You had... I mean, before that, you had groups like Simandi and Gonzalez.
Yeah.
Were they... Was there a connection between those mid-70s groups and the new lot, or was it part of a jazz-funk movement that was just coming through?
We were definitely from a different movement. Those guys really had the closed doors on those sessions. Because I remember back then trying to get Richard Bailey as my drummer from Gonzalez, and he wouldn't come to play with us. Kind of, he was like, you know, he was with the big boys, you know. He was like, yeah, 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 one day come talk to me, you know. It's like, yeah, yeah, get your thing together, you know. It was like that, you know. These bigger boys were kind of like, saying, go and get your shit together before you come and play with us,
right,
you know?
Right.
So we would, we were really you know, we would go up to Ronnie Scott's upstairs where they had the dance nights, and they'd have the live bands. And there were bands like Ritual, which you don't hear now, but, you know, it's like, they were relevant bands, you know, at the time. High Tension. That's where I first saw High Tension playing live, you know, in there. And I thought, oh my goodness, ever since I saw Earth, Wind & Fire, I hadn't seen a British band try to touch something on those lines, you know, with the horns and the percussion. But young kids, you know, it's like not the Gonzales, not the guys that were already so far advanced they were into the Latin stuff, you know. We hadn't kind of got into the Latin stuff. We were purely holding down the funk stuff.
Right.
You know, that was the difference. Those boys were bigger. They were older. They'd learned to play Latin music, you know. They'd kind of progressed in a way. We hadn't. We were still on the funk tip, you know, like a couple of chords dropping down and kind of like little chant, you know. We never had the singers like they had. Those boys had the singers. Kokomo, you'd go and see them play. They had singers. They were well organized, you know. We were raw. So this is where we came from. But then we'd started to listen to some mad little jazz tracks as well that these boys weren't listening to, because at that period the jazz stuff had started to kick in. You know, we'd start to discover this stuff, you know, through the fusion, through listening. The DJs we were hanging out with were playing more like Lonely Liston Smith and people like that, whereby those boys had been kind of coming through a Joe Cocker, you know, the British, the funk scene, you know, like, because, you know, there was like, there was a real strong, strong music scene before us. We had to create our own identity.
Tracks like this. We'll be right back. total legend that is Bluey Mornick in the studio, Brownswick Basement special podcast action, and a great track from Charlie Rouse, Waiting on the Corner.
I thought, I'm going to open up your show with, man, it's like, I knew that we would relate to this, both of us, because this is this kind of sound was really important to both where we headed out, you know.
And the tracks we're going to play are going to be all chosen by Bluey. And do you remember the first time we did do that interview? Do you remember any songs that you played on that show?
Yeah. The one that sticks to mind is Ayerto. We played from the album with the flowers in the background, you know. It's like, I forgot the track, but it's got that little... That little triangle.
The Happy People.
It's Happy People, yeah.
The Happy People off I'm Fine, How Are You?
That's right.
Definitely introduced me to Ayerto, and I think through that I then heard Celebration Suite, and the rest is history.
Definitely.
with that particular tune. How does it feel to still be doing it? I mean, could you be doing anything else in your life? Have you ever sort of wondered, my God, this is too much, I've done too many gigs, I'm tired of airports and average hotels on the outskirts of Milan, I want to change. Does that happen to you sometimes?
Well, on my journeys, I get to be the other person that I possibly could have been. Working with children, I end up on a plane looking after somebody's kid, you know, because they've been traveling from Australia trying to get to somewhere across in Europe, and they've come through via Asia somewhere, and they're tired, and they no longer can keep their eyes open, and I take over, you know. I usually have two or three kids, you know, on a flight sitting down, and we all kind of like, I get out the drawings and I entertain kids. I would have been working with children for definitely.
Yeah, you're a definite children magnet, because I know that when you come to my place, they love you and they always ask where's Bluey. Your dad was a poet.
Yeah.
And he still is a poet.
Still is, yeah.
So basically, you could have gone into that. I mean, you've always been quite lyrical. Obviously, you write lyrics, right?
Yeah, but I think I more or less came into it kind of late.
Where did it go wrong for you? I mean, how come you ended up a musician? What happened? I mean, what was going on?
The musician thing was like, my grandmother and my grandfather and one of my uncles really believed in the dream. You know, I was 5 years old. It was on the beaches of Mauritius, and it's the only place where I discovered music. We never had a radio in the house. There was no TV, you know, there, and my family only sang in church and stuff, you know. It was only hymns sung around the house, and then they took me to the beach one day. I remember I was around 5 years old, and I heard Sega music, you know. I heard this rhythm thing, and I wanted to be part of that rhythm. I wanted to be part of the music, the songs, you know. It's like, and I saw how a man singing a song to a crowd that were just kind of like, you know, lackluster, bringing them to life. And I wanted that job. That's the job I applied for, you know. And I asked my grandmother, can I do this? And she turned around to me and she said, yeah, you are. I know you are. This is what you're going to do. And she said it in such a way that it, you know, it just stuck with me ever since, you know. I knew that's what I was going to be doing for the rest of my life.
never heard that before. that's a new version of Don't Worry About a Thing.
Well, it's not so new. It's 1972 from Peru.
with interesting chord changes.
Oh, I love the chord changes, especially that chord in the chorus, you know, the last chord in the chorus. Ah!
Now, that was one of the moments that I enjoyed the most there was lots of great moments working at Talking Loud, but one of the moments that I was really disappointed not to be there was the day that Stevie Wonder turned up at the studio to perform a little bit of accordion on this track when you'd recorded it as incomplete.
No, he played harmonica on the remix of Change.
Not accordion, on harmonica, that's yeah. right. Yeah, yeah.
On the Change remix, because right. I had never had a track up. It's the only track I had in the studio.
Right.
And he came like he just on the spur of the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that was amazing.
I'll be down in the studio in a minute.
That was amazing. Bluey, you've worked with so many, and you've motivated and inspired so many musicians along the way. I think one of your real important gifts to the world of music, apart from being this, you know, running this amazing band, is also the fact that you've managed to encourage so many musicians over the years. I mean, do you feel that that's quite an important part of you? I mean, you were saying that you've always, if you weren't working in music, you'd be working with children. In a way, you, with musicians, you are working with children, right?
Oh yeah, definitely.
I mean, so I mean,
especially if you saw the band I got right now. Oh gee.
but is that, you know, how
at this moment I should say the name Pete Ray Begin, just in case he listens, our new drummer.
But is that important to you? Obviously, that whole
of course,
yeah,
of course. It's you know, sometimes, in a way, I may even like kind of lost sight of my own direction with, like, you know, it was hard being a family man when you were trying to kind of get all this together, you know. And it's like, and I'm finding myself at a later stage in life, but I've always known that I wanted to do something with music that was more than just go out and play, you know, because I go out and play is my own selfish kind of thing, you know. But I wanted to kind of share it with people, you know. That's the band that I had. I remember being in Light of the World, and they were so, like, you know, they were a team, you know, and it was us against every other band. It was like war, you know. If we were on the same bill as somebody else, if the talk in the changing was almost like we're gonna like tear their heads off, you know. And it was like a gang ready to go into a fight.
Mm.
And I was always a bit older than the rest of the guys, you know. I mean, Tubbs was 14 when he joined the band. Do you know what I mean? So when he formed a band, I met him when he was like 15. They'd been kind of like putting this idea together. And by the time I left the band, it was one of the reasons were, you know, of course, Chris Etienne passed in the accident, percussionist that was with us. And it made me take a step, you know, into like what, looking at my life. And I wanted to play with all these other guys in other bands, guys from Gonzales, you know, guys from High Tension, you know, people like Ray Carless that I'd seen on the scene, jazz funk scene in the UK. You know, I wanted to work with different people. So the reason why Tubbs and I did this project was Tubbs was going to stay in Light of the World, and I was going to be on it, kind of guiding this project and looking after this project, you know, whilst we were still in other bands, you know. So, you know, at that point, I was ready to kind of give an opening to various ideas. And
I mean,
that's what.
And you've also worked with a whole heap of singers.
Mm.
I mean, that's another one of your, I think, I mean, I've seen you at work in the studio, and there's playing and there's being in a band and controlling a band and developing a band, but there's also producing a band.
Mm.
And that's always been the thing that, you know, in the studio, and I've always thought that your ability to get the best out of people is a real, one of your real strengths.
I think that's my main strength, really, because, you know, there's better guitarists, there's better songwriters, there's better musicians than me. But I think that sometimes every time I go into studio and I'm sitting on a session, I want to say something, because I want to make the thing better. I want to make it work for people. I want to communicate something to people. So I know I can do that well.
And what's been the best singer that you, I mean, obviously it's a difficult one to say, but is there one singer that you've worked with that you've thought, my God, this is the most amazing singer?
Well, the thing is, you know, there are people, you know, the first time you were instrumental in actually getting me together with Jocelyn Brown, you know, and somebody like that coming in and blowing your mind, but you already knew that she had that pedigree, you already knew what she was capable of, you know, like what she could do. But
by the way, one of the greatest ever moments, truly one of the greatest moments for me, was Incognito at Dingwalls.
Yeah.
Jocelyn Brown doing somebody else's guy.
Yeah.
And then you had to do it again as an encore.
That's right.
That was just top 10 highlights of all time. You remember that, right?
I do remember it. I do remember it. Well, I do remember it. And I remember you saying to me at one of Southport, and there was a girl called Janice Hoyt who was singing at the time, and you said to me, you heard us do Always There, and you said, you got to cut this tune. And then you tried to get Chaka Khan to sing it, but she weren't available. Then you found Jocelyn, you know, and it's like, you know, that was a great, you know, that really gave us a strong, strong direction. And the whole house thing with Incognito happened because of that as well, because of the Morales mix. But going back to what you're saying as singers, sometimes you find your muse as well. Mesa is definitely, you know, coming into the band, and, you know, that voice and my songwriting
incredible.
really works well. Yeah. You know, her voice and my songs, I think that even the stuff that she went on to do, I think that I feel kind of proud that I've been able to kind of give her a direction, and I feel proud that she came in and gave us a focus, you know, a focal point.
Talking of singers, I want to just bypass a couple of the tracks on your track list, and I want to go straight to track 6 on here, which I'm just pleased that you put it on the CD. Let's play it.
So new, and I'm so glad that I found you.
Just going a little bit somewhere different. I mean, not the obvious tracks.
No. but people were begging for this in Italy this week. Why didn't you put this in the set? I may have to put it back in the set.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Let's play another track. This is obviously a live thing, and this is from an LP, which I don't even think I've got myself, which is an Incognito live album, On Talking Loud.
On Talking Loud. But at the time, I couldn't get hold of you to say, can we do this album? And I think you would have given us the go-ahead, but the record company was a little bit weary. But the people in Japan, they wanted it because it was all set up from the night before. There was a band there. They had the equipment left behind. That's the only way we managed to do this. They had left the equipment at the venue. And they said, look, rather than break it down, we'll kind of let you record it for cheap, you know. So we kind of all went to the bank and tried to get our cash cards in and pull the money in to kind of pay for it. It was great.
And it's good to see the lineup of the band on this. This is the classic track Colibri, which was a bit of a crossover club track for you as well, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah. And if you don't play it at one of the gigs, you'll get lynched. You know, I mean, it's like this, like we wouldn't walk out alive.
And the band, just looking back, Mesa on vocals. You had Chris Balin on vocals as well.
Yeah.
Imani on the vox, Richard Bailey, ex-Gonzalez, yeah, on the drums, yeah. Randy Taylor,
yeah,
at the bass, yeah. Brilliant. Oh, who's that? Oh, so you can't hear it, you haven't got any headphones on. Graham Harvey, he was always the MD, wasn't he?
Yeah, Graham was, yeah.
Peter Hines is on there.
I think you just heard Thomas Diani doing his thing on
that's
percussion,
right,
and voice, yeah.
Right. Thomas Diani... Ed Jones,
yeah.
Wow, amazing. You can't have made much money being in such a huge band, right? Because I mean,
never have.
But it's a big collective, basically,
yeah,
to shout about and to shoot around the place.
Oh yeah, it's
especially with you travelling in business class.
Every year I get at least from the management or from the record company end, you know, it's like I always get like, can you narrow down the band? Can you do a smaller version?
Yeah.
You know, it's like we would like work almost every day if we had a smaller version, because like this place is just want to put us on, you know. But, you know, I'm staying true to this one to the end. Don't even bother asking me in future. It's going to get bigger, if anything.
I'm curious to ask you a couple of more questions, because we were talking, yeah, about Talking Loud just now, and this album which came out in Japan, through Talking Loud. I mean, it was a very dramatic period for me.
Mm.
Of course, the whole era of Talking Loud, because I started when I was 24, and
yeah,
it was there for 10 years later, and it really was a period of time when major labels just didn't have subsidiaries like us, so there was so much education, so much battling to be done every day. I was just talking to some people upstairs. I remember when Judge Jules turned up at Mercury Records, because he had a subsidiary that came up about 6 or 7 years after mine called Manifesto,
yeah,
and I remember I'd been trying to sign this record by Josh Wing called Higher State of Consciousness,
yeah,
and I remember that he turned up all kind of cocky and everything, and the first record that he got from the bosses who signed the checks was Higher State of Consciousness. I remember thinking how annoyed I was at the time,
yeah,
and this kind of reminded, yeah, me of the sort of the constant battles that we'd have,
yeah.
And I mean, obviously, you know, we were all together on this, and you understood the period and the difficulties that I was having, and we made it work, right?
Yeah, we did. Sometimes we, you know, you had to kind of, I had to learn, you know, you had to teach me, and then sometimes I had to kind of teach you about what I was trying to do. So we learned from each other, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of mad times. And what was the one album that you kind of enjoyed doing the most at Talking Loud, that you thought from beginning to end it was like
Beneath the Surface? Yeah, because it was one where I was just really into my writing at that point, and you kind of like you never kind of put any barriers on me at all, you know. It was, you know, we'd done the house thing, you know, we'd worked with, you know, you'd had a real heavy input in there, and you kind of like let me just get on with a record. But the way that you kind of supported me in that record was like in a way that I'd always wanted to be supported. You said go to America, and we did strings, you know. It's like we had people like Ronnie Cuba, you know, like come in on baritone sax. I was working, you know, I was, you know, you suggested to me to go to the Column d'Or to go and to go and write, you know,
right.
be a good place, you know.
Did I pay for it?
You did, yeah.
Did I?
Yeah.
God,
you
there
did.
Was, there was money.
I
in
didn't
it,
have but... any money.
Wow. I couldn't do that now.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. Wow.
So,
interesting times.
Yeah.
Interesting times. I remember 100 Degrees and Rising being I just remember that time, that album being quite an enjoyable album to make. But I mean, there was
that was amazing, because that's the first time. Actually, if it was a recording experience, an actual recording experience that cannot be beaten for me,
yeah,
was going down to Abbey Road to record strings on that 100 Degrees and Rising album,
yeah,
for the first time.
Yeah.
You know, in the studio with strings, for me, it was like, and with Simon Hale. You know, it's like amazing.
Okay, I don't know where to go on your list here. Where do you feel we should go? There's we've got the Eugene McDaniels track, which I'm quite keen to hear.
Go on then.
Should we play that one?
Yeah.
What is it, 4? Or
yeah, it's 4.
It's number 4. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Don't you know he's a loving man? Got his moon in Taurus. A heavy humble, yeah. Sensuality seeker. You really know when he's been there. He is kind.
Never check this track on the album. I just listen. I play Cherry Stones or the other. There's like two or three songs that I always play. But this is brilliant.
This is the killer for me. This is the one that speaks to me the most of all his stuff. I mean, he's a deep cat. I mean, he's. But this 1971, man. Listen to the sound of it. I want my record to sound like this now.
Eugene McDaniel's Loving Man, Headless Heroes of the Apocalypse. Did you discover this at the time, or was this something that you kind of...
I discovered Eugene McDaniel's for you, and this track I'd missed out on too. I found this track on iTunes.
Oh right, yeah. Well, maybe it's not on the album. I mean,
no, it is.
Is it?
It is.
Wow.
It is.
Yeah, but I mean, making music sound like this, is it possible in 2009 with technology and stuff? You know, can you, even at the most classic of studios with the best equipment, is it something just missing now somehow, the way the electric power has changed? Or,
you know, it's like it should be like this. We, you know, it's like back, you know, I used to think to myself, how did Stevie Wonder and people like that create music like this? Yeah, there was the Vietnam War going on, you know, it's like that. Marvin Gaye took that in and put that in what's going on, you know. There was all this. We have wars going on now. We have crisis going on all over the world. We have, we have the same intensity with relationship. The problem is that nowadays, you know, there is something forcing us to go commercial. There is something forcing us to kind of water down what we do. There was nothing pushing the artists.
But in a way, you know, I think now you can actually reverse that. And
Because there was Watch This Space, my next album.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's got to be like that. But I think I get the feeling with other musicians that in a way, you know, on one hand, what's selling? Well, pure out and out pop music is selling. Which is just commercialized music, but the other side of the coin, actually, people want it to be pretty deep, don't they? In a way,
and exactly. You know, I mean, it's like there's still people make. I mean, there is the equivalent to now. I mean, I listen to Little Dragon, and I'm thinking to myself, this does exist. It's just a different sound. It's now, you know, it's like somebody is actually saying something and they've got a great sound, you know. It's not just replicating the sound of back then. I'm likely to do that because I am from back then.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 52 years old. You know, what am I going to do? Mm. You know, it's like I'm not just going to look for the new thing. Mm. I'm going to play a part of what's in me,
yeah.
You know. But I think it's just saying...
If you could go to any studio in the world and with all your experience and have any engineer in the world and any band in the world, right, and to make that ultimate record that sounds, you know, sort of as organic as Eugene McDaniel's and all the best records in the world, I mean, I think it's doable if you could imagine having the amount of time. Because, I mean, even when D'Angelo made his albums, they spent weeks in the studio.
Oh, months, years.
Months, you know, and as a result, it was kind of, it ended up sounding, you know...
Special.
It had its sound. So yeah, what would be your studio and your engineer and who would master it?
Oh my god. Engineer would have to be my man who done all the CTI
Creed Taylor.
No, the engineer is
Rudy Van Gelder.
Rudy Van Gelder.
Right.
You know, he used to hide Tommy Lupima when I worked with on George Benson's album, he told me, you know, Rudy would hide his settings on the desk. He'd have a plastic kind of like cover that, you know, he put his hands underneath and then he would kind of tweak it but not let you see what he was doing.
So I can believe that.
So he would be the one. And you know, I still think one of the best guys for cutting was like Clear Mountain, you know. But Clear Mountain is really good cutting man.
And if you could have any musicians, would you just stick with what you've got? Or I mean, you know, in a way, imagine you couldn't have your band that you've currently got and that you could have a kind of all-time band. You know, who would be playing bass for you?
Motown boy, my head's gone. What's his name, Junior? My head's gone. What's his name on Motown?
So's mine.
The Motown bass player. I've forgotten his name. You guys are gonna kill me for this. All the bass players.
Cleveland Eaton or something.
No. I've forgotten his name. He passed away. And kind of Jacko kind of took over from what he kind of like. He did.
Drums.
Idris Mohammed. Yeah.
Okay, and have you got sort of percussionists and stuff?
Percussionist Ralph McDonald.
Ralph McDonald, as opposed to Paulino da Costa.
No, Ralph McDonald. Definitely. He knows how to play soul music.
And like, Steve Gadd on the drums.
Well, we said Idris. Yeah, I mean, so... I think Idris around that whole 70s period for me. Idris is the. When he's, Idris is playing funk.
Horn section?
Earth, Wind & Fire.
Earth, Wind & Fire.
Early days. Or really early Cool in the Gang, called Carlos Bayan.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
And some of the boys from Band of Black Rio as well. You know, those guys.
Have you thought about the bass player yet? No. Singers.
Oh, man. Oh, God, his name's gone out.
Have you seen that film Soul Power yet?
No.
It's that documentary, I should give it to you. It's the documentary of, it was basically the concert that was taking place around the same time as Rumble in the Jungle, which was the Muhammad Ali, George Foreman fight in Zaire. And around that fight, they also arranged a concert. And there's a documentary of that concert.
Oh, yeah.
And it's got the Fine Euro Stars in it. It's got James Brown in it.
I've seen clips.
It's got Bill Withers in it.
All right. Oh man,
Bill Withers, underrated.
I was going to put that on this list as well. You know, there's some stuff.
Yeah,
I've got all the Bill Withers now. I've searched it out. I've got everything now.
Is he still around? What happened to Bill Withers? I'd love to see him perform. Just him and a guitar.
Yeah, I mean that live album at the Carnegie Hall.
Double.
I mean,
Grandma's rocking chair and.
That is a band. I mean, I'll take that band any day. You know what I mean?
So, okay, let's play a couple more. We haven't got much time, but let's do it. Let's play this one. I just feel like it.
Junkie walking through the twilight. I'm on my way home. I left 3 days ago, but no one seems to know I'm gone. Home is where the hatred is. Home is filled with pain. And it may not be such a bad idea if I never went home again. the beats. Close your eyes and watch me die. You keep saying kick it, quit it, Lord, but did you ever try to turn your sick soul inside out so that the world, so that the world can watch you die? Home is where I live inside, white powder dreams. Home was once an empty vacuum that's filled now with my silent screams. Home is where the needle marks try to heal my broken heart. It might not be such a bad idea if I never, never went home. Stand as far away from me as you can and ask me why. Hang on to your rosary beads, close your eyes, watch me die. You keep saying kick it, quit it, Lord, but did you ever try to turn your sick soul inside out so that the world, so that the world can watch you die, can watch you die, watch you die, watch you die. You say kick it, you keep saying quit it, did you ever try?
Esther Phillips, Home is Where the Hatred Is. Bluey, I want to say thank you very much for the last 30 years, and I want to, honestly, I love you so much, and you've had such an inspiration for me in all that I've done, more than anybody. Just the mere fact that, you know what, as well about you is the fact that you always worked hard, and I really looked up to that, because when we were basically learning our craft in the music industry, it's very easy just to kind of get stoned, have fun, do our thing. But unless you work
hard, which we did,
which we did, of course. But you were always working hard in the studio, and I was thinking, you know, there was times when, you know, when you can easily just kind of go, okay, let's go back tomorrow, or we'll work overnight and we'll make sure we get it nailed. And you always did that, and that's, you know, respect. I mean, you got this gig coming up. When's the date?
22nd of August. At the O2 Indigo.
Brilliant. And it's already almost sold out, isn't it?
So yeah, almost.
It's not like you need any help with it. But but basically, have a great gig there. We did speak recently about getting the... Well, it'd be difficult because Tubbs isn't with us anymore, sadly. But to try and get a jazz funk Incognito, just a one-off little night, would be great. Replay the album. But
yeah, yeah. But we'll, you know, I think... Once I get this out of the way, who knows? Maybe next year we'll do it, you know? Or we'll do something close to it.
Thank you so much. We're going to finish off. Who was the bass player?
James Jamieson. Yeah. I got a feeling he was on an Esther Phillips track. It sounded like him.
Take care, man.
Hey, thank you.
Bill Withers.
Grandma's Hands.
Let's go.
Grandma's hands clapped in church on Sunday morning. Grandma's hands played a tambourine so well. Whoa. Grandma's hands used to issue out a warning. She'd say, Billy, don't you run so fast. Might fall on a piece of glass. Might be snakes there in that grass. Grandma's hand. Grandma's hand soothed the local unwed mother.
grandma's hands. Used to ache sometimes and swell, oh. Grandma's hands used to lift her face and tell her she'd say, baby, grandma understands that you really love that man. Put yourself in Jesus' hand, grandma's hand. Grandma's hands used to hand me a piece of candy. Grandma's hands picked me up each time I fell. Oh, grandma's hands, boy, they really came in a handy. She'd say, Matty, don't you whip that boy. What you wanna spank him for? He didn't drop no apple core, but I don't have grandma anymore. If I get to heaven, I'll look for grandma's hand.